had kids shows then on Saturday morning. So you'd go down on Saturday morning and take your milk carton or whatever, you know, mordido that you used to get into the movie. Whereas Scoop will remember, all you had to have was your Gandy's half gallon milk carton.
Yeah.
Empty half gallon milk carton, though.
What happened to the milk on Saturday morning when I was headed off to the movie? I just told her I drank all the milk.
You didn't pour it down the sink, did you?
Of course I did. I wasn't that big a milk fan.
Yeah, I mean, this was a great thing about that era. I don't know that there's any place in the world that they do this now.
Well, you guys had that. I love that story of the theater for me. So I'm about 10-ish years behind y'all, you know, so it was late 60s, early 70s for me. We didn't have the theater thing, but we had a really great UHF station in the DC area. It was always this thing, like in the morning, you'd have the Saturday morning cartoons, which is great. And I could have my Quisp or my Quake cereal. And then in the afternoon, it was all the old sci-fi movies. And, you know, so I have this fondness of that, you know, that time. It was so cool. You know, it scared the crap out of me.
Before the internet changed the way we experience movies, dark theaters and late night TV were the sole venues where sci-fi and horror fans could get a regular fix of cheap movie thrills. This time on the Plutopia podcast, John, Scoop, and Maggie discuss their favorite classic films from the golden age of sci-fi and horror.
We were going to talk about Monsters from the Id tonight. And I have a whole list of movies for us to talk about. But the one that was highest on my list, let me see, I can show you here, is...
Yeah, it's great talking about monsters that have nothing to do with the Trump administration, for one.
Right.
So this Island Earth. And the reason I'm picking on this Island Earth is because I watched it. I reviewed it today. I checked it out. And
how many thumbs up did you give it?
Three thumbs up. Wait. So the deal with this Island Earth is it was like a really great, fairly big budget science fiction movie for its time in the 50s. I think it was released around, 56, 58, 56, maybe 57. Actually, I think it was maybe even 55, but it was released in the mid 50s, and it got mixed reviews. But you know, the people who kind of understood science fiction and were really into it and loved it. And for, you know, science fiction films of the time, it was pretty good. It wasn't a long, complicated story. It was a fairly simple movie in a way. But one of the things that happened to this movie is that it fell into the hands of our friends at Mystery Science Theater. And as much as I love Mystery Science Theater, I think they really did a disservice to this Island Earth, because the very fact that they used it diminished its reputation, because most of the movies that, you know, that they would screen and make fun of were, you know, fairly lame movies. And here's a really pretty decent movie. And they're sort of, not only did they make fun of it, but in order to do their kind of overlay that they do, they, well, for one thing, they shortened the movie. They cut stuff out of it, and then they did the overlay, and the quality of the picture was not very good. And this is a movie that was really beautifully made, very colorful, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. kind of great in that respect. And Mystery Science Theater dimmed it down with their process. So people came to think of this island Earth as just kind of one of the terrible 50s B movies. It wasn't really a B movie. It was meant to be, you know, a big production. It was a big production, 2.5 years in the making, which they made sure you knew in their advertising. So I didn't know all of this. I mean, I didn't think about all this stuff. This just recently I started thinking about the effect of Mystery Science Theater. But at the time the movie came out, my brother and I were really crazy about it. In fact, we made a big deal about wanting to see it after I think we saw a preview. We did not call it This Island Earth. We called it Green Flying Saucer.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, the flying saucer wasn't green, but the flying saucer did have a green ray that it deployed in a couple of important parts of the film. So we picked up the green from that. And I believe that we saw the movie eventually at the Sahara Drive-In in Big Spring, Texas, which was a two-screen theater there. I think that's where we saw it. We may have seen it at the kids' show, where, as Scoop will remember, all you had to have was your Gandhi's half-gallon milk carton.
Yeah.
Empty half-gallon milk carton, though.
What happened to the milk cone on Saturday morning when I was headed off to the movie? I just told her I drank all the milk.
You didn't pour it down the sink, did you?
Of course I did. I wasn't that big a milk fan.
Yeah, I mean, this was a great thing about that era. I don't know that there's any place in the world that they do this now, but they had kids shows then on Saturday morning. So you'd go down on Saturday morning and take your milk carton or whatever, you know, Mordito that you used to get into the movie, and they would show something suitable for kids.
Well, I have to speak up in defense of my alum. I'm an alumnus of the Gizmonics Institute and a big fan of the Satellite of Love. So I've spent way too much time watching Mystery Science Theater. And, you know, I don't think it really harmed, you know, they've had some pretty good movies that they, you know, made fun of. But that's kind of a sign that you've really arrived in certain quarters, such as my quarters. If you made it onto Mystery Science Theater 3000, you're at least noticeable, because there's a lot of movies that were so bad that they never made the cut, even for that program. And I don't think it tarnished the reputation more than it just, you know, was nice to get a laugh at someone else's expense, as long as they're not laughing at us.
What incarnation of Mystery Science Theater, because I don't think I've seen it on there. What incarnation was it?
This was actually the movie that they released when they, and they may have done more than one movie, but they had this initial big screen Mystery Science Theater movie.
Okay.
And I suppose they chose a little bit better film for that, because it was, you know, it was a movie versus their usual television thing.
Yeah, plus it's hard to negotiate the clearances on things, because so they probably went through a lot of different movies before someone finally agreed to let them do it. Because basically, they had to get the people who own the rights to the movie to say, okay, you can make fun of us, just be kind to us. And they weren't, of course. But, yeah, I was a big fan of the original, you know, Mystery Science Theater. You know, they went through a number of different incarnations, and they've got a web-based ones now that it's pretty good.
But so you're a Joel
the original
Hudson
was just so unexpected and in my opinion delightful, because I'm kind of that kind of person. I love sarcasm and irony, and I try to incorporate it into my daily life.
But don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan of Mystery Science Theater. I just am also a big fan of this Island Earth.
Well, but would it feel to you, John, kind of like if they did that, and I hope they didn't do it, to Forbidden Planet?
Ooh.
I don't know if they did Forbidden Planet.
They didn't do Forbidden Planet.
Well, good.
That would be. Yeah. Well, I mean, the real problem is that you don't really get a good quality view of the movie when you're watching it on MST3K. And it, you know, to me, it makes sense for them to use, you know, the Killer Shrews or something like
right.
that.
right.
I mean, the Killer Shrews was made for, like, I think maybe an empty Gandhi's milk carton was their budget for that.
What was the Christmas movie, the Santa Claus?
Versus the Martians.
Versus the Martians. One of my favorite. I watch that every year at Christmas just to piss off the family. But
was that made in the 50s or later?
50-ish, I think. I forget what the date was, but it was pretty rudimentary entertainment. Right.
Well, you guys had that. I love that story of the theater for me. So I'm about 10-ish years behind y'all, you know, so it was late 60s, early 70s for me. We didn't have the theater thing, but we had a really great UHF station in the DC area. It was always this thing, like in the morning, you'd have the Saturday morning cartoons, which is great. And I could have my Quisp or my Quake cereal. And then in the afternoon, it was all the old sci-fi movies. And, you know, so I have this fondness of that, you know, that time. It was so cool, you know, it scared the crap out of me. But yeah, but it was also in the Mid-Atlantic. I mean, this is not a movie, but I watched Ultraman. And it wasn't until I moved away to like Colorado and California, none of my friends never saw it. So I think it was only in limited markets. You know,
my favorite Zen teacher, Brad Warner, worked on Ultraman.
Really? Oh my
yeah,
God.
Yeah. He worked for that studio in Japan when he was at the same time studying Zen Buddhism.
Wow, that's so cool.
I did find that Santa Claus Conquers the Martians was a 1964 movie. And
the
I see that it was produced by Joseph E. Levine. Can you believe that?
Wow.
The Martians kidnapped Santa. Oh, wow. Sorry
about
that.
See how they are?
Well,
Ultraman. Oh, we should go back to Ultraman. When was Ultraman? Do you remember, Maggie, exactly when it was?
It was like, I'm thinking like 64, 65, 66, something like that. And why I thought it was so cool is that, the super, kind of the fighting team, the hero team, they had women, right? And I was like, oh my God, they're wearing the same uniforms as the men. It was like not like Star Trek with the little skimpy skirts and everything. They were wearing the full uniforms like the guys. And I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. So,
well, you were talking about your UHF station that was your provider in the Bay Area. When I moved to the Bay Area, I was thrilled to find Creature Features on Channel 2.
Yeah.
In Oakland. The great Bob Wilkins, who did a marvel. In fact, let me share Bob Wilkins with you. That's Bob right there.
Okay. Oh, my God.
Our friends Keep America Strong. And he was there on this, let's see, he took it over, it says here, he started the show in 1971, and another guy took it over in 1979. But the sad thing about Bob Wilkins is he was so into the horror and sci-fi films that he kind of lost it. I actually saw him on the streets by Doggy Diner in downtown Oakland, kind of looking lost and wandering around. And apparently he had started to take the whole, you know, sci-fi and horror thing to an extreme, to where the station kind of had to say, Bob, time to go over to this facility and spend some time there because they don't have any monsters.
Oh, my God.
But the Bay Area had a lot of good stuff like that.
Well, speaking of that, Where we grew up, Scoop and I in West Texas, they had one of the greatest of the late night horror movie screening shows, Shock Theater, on KMID-TV, Midland, Texas. Do you remember that, Scoop?
Oh, yes.
Wow. Wally Jackson. There was a guy named Wally Jackson who I later met and hung out with a little bit. But Wally Jackson put on a big cloak and called himself Iago and did this really great like thing where he would like come out and introduce the movie. And then, you know, when commercials ran, he would also, they would have him come on and do various things. I mailed him a bunch of stuff one time and he actually opened my little package there and talked about it. I was just nuts about that. That was on Friday nights.
Right.
We'd go to the football game and then I'd watch Shock Theater after that.
Well, you know, the day the earth stood still, I was looking in Wikipedia and it was talking about the critical response. And that's one of my favorite, movies from that period. Yeah. And apparently some of the critics found it, where's the exact words? They found it had certain subversive elements. This was back during the Red Scare days. So apparently this whole thing of let's all get together and live in peace was subversive. And it's like, that was from the L.A. Times, of course.
Right.
It wasn't just that. They also kind of made fun of people who were paranoid about the Russians. You know, like there was a woman at the boarding house where he was staying that made some comment about, well, we know where it probably really came from, you know.
And the military didn't come off too well either in its role there. So yeah, that was certain subversive elements. I liked that one.
That movie, incidentally, was directed by the great Robert Wise, who got his start making movies with Val Lewton, who made these great low-budget horror movies back in the 40s.
Is he the one that did Sound of Music?
Well, I think he did Sound of Music. He definitely did West Side Story. And I can tell you that he made a much better West Side Story than Steven Spielberg did, in my humble opinion.
Well, speaking of, as I was, of the day the earth stood still, in 2008, there was another one with Keanu Reeves as Klaatu. I'll let you think about that for a moment. let that soak in.
You know, I actually was fond of that movie. I kind of liked it. It was, you know, it really wasn't a great remake as a remake, but it was kind of a fun movie in its own right. And it had Jennifer Connelly in it. Jennifer Connelly's pretty terrific.
Okay, there we go. We've got
Keanu Reeves. If you want somebody to play an alien, Keanu's not a bad guy for that.
Yeah.
Well, when I was a kid, I had a kind of, a crush on Michael Rennie. You know, I was kind of like, I want him to be my dad. I don't want my dad to be my dad. I want Klaatu to be my dad. Like, he seems civilized and he dressed well and, you know, urbane and the way he talked. I'm like,
yeah. Well, you know, the whole thing, Klaatu Narada Nikto.
Barada.
Barada Nikto. Anyway, Keanu Reeves, to his credit, insisted that they include that in that line in the film because the remake was going to cut it out, which was like, what? And he had to, you know, actually make a big stink to have it added to the script. It didn't help him because, you know, Rotten Tomatoes gave it a 21% rating, so it did not go over well with the listeners.
I liked it.
I know there's like, you know, some of them are really cool, the remakes. There's something about this feeling of those, you know, just thinking about the Day the Earth Stood Still again. It's just the something about the beauty of the black and white and the mm-hmm. music, that weird theremin music and everything. I don't know. It's that some of those black and white films from that time are oddly comforting to me, and I'm not quite sure why.
I was a big fan of Bernard Herrmann's music, all the soundtracks that he did. And he did that particular film. He did a lot of the Ray Harryhausen movies and Alfred mm-hmm. Hitchcock's films. Such a distinctive sound, you know? And well, go ahead.
No, those movies back then, when the black and white movies were really great, when they were done well, there were some black and white stinkers, a lot of them. But but when it was done well, I mean, it's just something I'll go and watch, you know, endlessly.
Right. Yeah, and even though it's not a film, one of my favorite Twilight Zone episodes is the one where that woman's off in a cabin in the woods and the sheriff, you know, there's something lands and something, she's hearing things outside and it's all the, you know, they're freaked out. Like, I think something crushed a car or something. And then the next day after spending all this time together, they go outside and there's this big giant alien, you know, and then he shoots at it and it deflates. Right. And I don't know if you remember that one, but I thought it was brilliant. Just kind of capturing the vibe I remember from that time, you know, when he had stories of UFOs and all this other stuff and the sphere. And I don't know, it was brilliant. There's just,
Yeah, that was kind of, you know, the othering of things. So it was kind of the subtext in a lot of those movies of, you know, it was, the monsters were substitutes for certain boogeymen and boogeywomen, if you will.
Right.
So I'm wondering if I've got the right one. I think I tracked that down. Was it called The Invaders, that particular episode? And did it have Agnes Moorehead in it?
No, that's the one with the little UFO on the roof. That was brilliant. Okay. That's another brilliant one. And yeah, it was... it was just this really sophisticated woman who was getting away from the city and she came to stay in this cabin and the sheriff comes to check on her. And I wish I could remember the name. You don't see it a lot and I don't know why, or at least when they do the, you know, the marathons and the rotation and syndication. I would always be excited when I saw it.
I found a short documentary on YouTube the other day about a Twilight Zone episode called To Serve Man. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The
yum.
Head guys.
Yeah. About the aliens who came to Earth to serve man. Parboiled, probably.
Are you being served?
Yes.
Well, my favorite was always the Bill Shatner, There's Something on the Wing episode. You know, it wasn't great drama, but it was weird.
Yeah. Yeah. God, what brilliant writing. That's something I missed too about the, when they were still thinking in the mindset of a teleplay instead of television, you know, so it was still, there was content and context and all that. And it, you know, Hunter and I talked about it before, how I raised her on that stuff. So she has a sense of how cool it is. But she said a lot of kids her age could not handle watching any of that stuff because it moves too slowly. You know, there's not enough boom, 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 boom. And I'm like, damn, that sucks. That's kind of a bummer because they're great story. It's great storytelling, the pacing and everything.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on the whole boom, 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 you know, quick cuts every 5 seconds in a lot of the recent movies. It's just overwhelming. The special effects are great until they just overwhelm the movie and there's no longer a story. It's just, you know, Michael Bay, I think, is the director who does all of those. You know, it's one explosion after another and one ridiculously impossible stunt after another. It's like, come on, let's see a little bit of reality.
Right. That's why I've never, you know, I don't like blood and gore movies. I like psychological horror, you know, like you're making all these things up in your mind just by movements or sounds or whatever. I find that like The Haunting of Hell House or something like that. That was the crap out of me.
The house.
How about this? I like to talk about The Thing.
The Thing.
Let's do it.
Yeah, The Thing from Another World.
Marshall Dillon is The Thing.
Yeah. That was such a great movie about teamwork. really. It was post-war, and Howard Hawks was the producer of that movie and influenced the making of it quite a bit. Christian Ivey, who had been his editor, was the director, but Howard Hawks was kind of around influencing the way the film was made, I guess. And there was this whole thing about how they wanted to show how a really great military team would work together, you know?
Right.
And they also showed how people would tend to crack jokes when they were in a situation like that, where they were thinking that they were going to be, you know, undone by a monster from outer space. And I have been known to show that movie as a team building thing, you know.
Interesting.
This is how people can work together, you know.
Right, right.
And there's a thing in there about, you know, there's Dr. Carrington, a scientist. So Dr. Carrington went a little nuts, and he did not want to kill this creature that was out to pretty much, you know, take over the world, because he wanted to learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
And what you saw was a very professional bunch of military people just trying to work around this scientist who had a certain amount of rank because he was running the research facility. And they sort of dealt with him. And they were, you know, they were nice about it, actually. And even though he was really creating a problem and a threat,
mm-hmm.
They kind of understood him. And the other scientists were, the scientists were kind of divided about what they thought should be done about this thing. But that particular film was based on a story called Who Goes There? That was written by a pretty famous science fiction author, but it was credited to Don A. Stewart. But Don A. Stewart was a pen name for John W. Campbell, who became the editor of Astounding Science Fiction, which became Analog Science Fiction.
Yeah, he was doing that thing that a lot of writers were doing of they really didn't want to muddy their reputation by being a Hollywood film.
Right, and he had married a woman named Donna Stewart, so he just appropriated her name.
Right.
But the original Who Goes There, this original story that it was based on, had a creature that could replicate any living thing. So it was really hard for them to figure out, is this the creature or is this actually my buddy, you know?
Is it real or is it Memorex?
And John Carpenter made a version of the movie in 1982 that was based on the original story and followed that. But in 51, they didn't have, they would have required too much budget to make that.
Right, film. Right. The John Carpenter one scared the crap out of me.
Yeah, I always thought the moral to that story was beware of bosses with good intentions.
Watch the skies. Interesting thing about that. There was a guy, let's see, what was his name? Douglas Spencer played a reporter named Scotty in The Thing from Another World. And he also played like the monitor, like the head alien in This Island Earth when they got to Meta Luna. He was kind of like the kind of unpleasant leader of the planet. Mm-hmm. Who was ready to have the Earthlings' brains fried. A bit of trivia. Sorry.
That's awesome. And I've been having hearing the call to like go back and read a lot of my old like Dell science fiction or whatever. And I have a whole stack of fantasy and science fiction from the 60s. That I bought it at the Berkeley flea market for like $3.
Wow.
And I'm wanting to like, you know, like everything is so hyper real now, you know, feels so dystopian and everything. I kind of want to go back into that realm and re-examine it from this perspective at this time and see what I pull out.
Yeah, they talk about a golden age of science fiction and you know, some of the science fiction was more utopian than dystopian then. And they presented a more positive view of the future and some of those things.
Right.
Going back to Hugo Gernsback, who started the first science fiction magazine. I can't remember. Was that IF? Which one was that? Anyway.
Well, what about 2001? Because that was a real, you know, it was both celebrated and condemned when it came out. You know, I was just looking in with the Wikipedia entry. Apparently, Rock Hudson left the L.A. premiere muttering, "What is this bullshit?" Then, of course, the producers realized that they were advertising it wrong, so they came out with their new poster that said 2001, the ultimate trip, because they realized people were smoking these funny cigarettes and taking funny substances and then going to see.
There's my poster for 2001. Yep. It says, an epic drama of adventure and exploration.
I tried to play it for my grandsons, who are real, you know, pretty hip guys, and they just couldn't handle it because it was, they said, it's so slow and there's no action. It's like, there is action, but it happens in a realistic manner. That's not how life is not a Michael Bay, you know, action film, you know, bang, bang, boom, boom. A lot of times it's just things are happening. And I enjoyed that movie a lot because of that, because it was, you know, taking its time to tell a story that was, you know, fascinating.
Right. Yeah, it was a great piece of cinema, as I think pretty much all Kubrick films were.
Right.
There's a lot of interesting stories about how that thing was made, including the fact that he nearly killed one guy who was playing, he was a stuntman standing for the astronaut doing the spacewalk. Hmm. And I think he nearly got dropped or something. And Kubrick actually hid from him after this happened because he was afraid the guy was going to slap him around.
Wow.
Yeah, the movie generated 1 billion screensavers on lots of guys named Dave. I can't do that, Dave.
Yeah. Open the pod bay door, Hal. Damn it. Well, it was kind of a weird thing that they started. This was like Arthur C. Clarke sort of came up with this thing and worked with Kubrick on it for a long time. But they were, I mean, there was what Clarke was doing was his idea for the movie was more prosaic. And if you read his book, it's not as mysterious as the movie is. And I remember reading the first thing I read about how this movie was being made, they talked about this pyramid that later became the
monolith.
The monolith.
And it became the monolith because, you know, it was hard for them to get the pyramid effect to work the way that that Kubrick wanted it to. And somebody came up with the monolith instead. And that was something that really worked. And he decided he liked that better. But there's an old song by the Byrds, a Space Odyssey song, that was based on that original idea. It talks about flying to the moon and discovering a pyramid. This was when the Byrds were in their science fiction phase, and it's on the Notorious Byrd Brothers. And this was all around, I guess it was 66 that was released, maybe 66, 67. But I recall going with, I was with some friends in Arizona. We were in Flagstaff, Arizona. And I saw that 2001 was screening in Cinerama in Scottsdale, Arizona, because I was looking for it. I was actively trying to find it at a Cinerama theater, which, you know, we didn't have in my little town. So we drove from Flagstaff to Scottsdale and watched the movie in Cinerama and just completely had our minds blown.
Yeah, I think the monolith there was a great symbol for the movie. You know, I mean, it was just so, you know, memorable. A pyramid, I'd seen plenty of pyramid, but this was a whole new kind of thing. And, you know, its interaction with the human race, well, with, you know, pre-humans and the human race over, you know, thousands of years was just, it was just a great device.
Right.
And what I think he was really so successful in capturing was that sense that when we really do meet extraterrestrials, it's going to be a very mysterious thing. And they're probably going to put us in a zoo, which is kind of what they did with Dave Bowman, you know?
Yeah, they're not all going to be coming in, you know, looking like, you know, some businessman in a nice hat and suit, and we want to shake your hand and move in next door. They may want to move in next door and lock you up.
Men in Black. Are we going to talk about UFOs? We had threatened to do that, too.
Yeah. UFOs?
Those UFOs are in the news this week.
UAPs.
You know, Congress finally caught up with us. We've been making noises for decades. No, let's have a hearing where not a lot really got disclosed because they had their classified hearing afterward.
Yeah,
I would love to get some notes.
Fly on the wall for that.
Yeah, I'm really curious which agencies are really, you know, who's dragging their feet, right? Because the Navy's come out with all this stuff, but there's frustration because they're trying to coordinate all the data, and there's certain agencies that are hiding things. I'm like, why are you hiding it? And like, you know, it's like, okay, great. Yeah, you're talking about it again, but could we learn something, please? I mean, you know, whatever it is, you know, if it's our own testing, if it's, I don't know, anyway.
Yeah, if you want some good UFO reading, there's a website called the Black Vault. I've got a link somewhere that has a whole cache of CIA declassified documents going way back to the early 20th century, and some of their stuff from during World War II was interesting about the so-called saucers that the Nazis were supposed to be working based on captured UFOs.
And
just, you know, the Russians and the CIA all were just freaked out by this, and really, you know, the people in charge really didn't want to have to deal with it because it was probably too scary what they were seeing. Yeah, because some of these documents were very interesting, and there were a lot of things going on in the Soviet Union, and they didn't know what to do about it.
Right. Yeah, I really wish, probably because I was researching this stuff or I posted about it, I saw this ad come across my feed, and it's for this UFO-like conference next weekend in Bernal, Utah. Now, that sounds weird, but that's a really – have you all ever been to Bernal, Utah, or Dinosaur National Monument area?
Yeah.
Green River? Yeah, I love that whole area. And it was like, oh my God, that'd be so cool. I wish I could jet up there and just participate, because there's going to be a lot of different, you know, it's not the as far as I can tell, the crystal alien shamanic people being there. It's more like various scientists and stuff that want to just sit and discuss it. And, you know, so that would be cool. And also, I wish I could go to this, but I'm sure all the hotels are booked up. But this July 4th is the 75th anniversary of the Roswell crash. So,
Space City.
There's also this. This is at Rice University. They have what they call the Archives of the Impossible, where they're actually collecting papers about paranormal, especially ufology. And this all started because Jacques Vallée was trying to figure out where to put his papers. And they're going to have those. They had a conference recently, and the conference sessions are all, I think all of them are on YouTube. So it's worth checking out. They they're actually creating a scholarly archive of this kind of stuff.
Thank you. God. Yeah. Dang, that's great. Thanks for both those tips, the Black Vault and
But there was another thing. So Scoop and I we've talked a lot about having guests who can talk about UFOs, and we've had a little trouble getting, you know, the right experts to join us.
Yeah, I tried to get Art Bell, but he isn't returning my calls.
Yeah, I bet. You know, maybe we could have a seance.
Yeah. I just wonder if that archive is going to have, it'd be great if they had like a archive of Coast to Coast AM, because that was such a bizarre
archive. And it's still there under new management, I guess.
Yeah, without Art and the usual crazies he had, it's just not the same.
Well, I was going to mention that when we were talking about doing something on UFOs, one guy I did get in touch with through Eric Davis was a guy named Mark Pilkington.
How do I know that name?
Mark Pilkington and another guy named Lundberg. I think it was John Lundberg. There was a book that they created called Mirage Men, and also a video called Mirage Men, or a movie. And the Mirage Men movie is available on YouTube.
Yeah, it's great.
It's really quite good. But it's what their research got into was they started uncovering evidence that of intelligence operations that were kind of like psyops that were trying to promote the idea of UFOs in order to distract or deflect from testing of various military projects that people were seeing. You know, I think, for instance, a lot of the triangular UFOs that people reported might have been what do they call that? The stealth bomber.
Well, they claimed it was drones, and that puzzled me. It's like they have a triangle drone.
I'm sure a lot of sightings,
like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, if you remember the whole premise there of, you know, hiding the alien contact behind a
anthrax or something,
a nerve release at the Dugway Proving Grounds, which is a real thing that was happening a lot because the sheep and cattle farmers there lost a lot of flocks to errant nerve gas drifting over from the military compound.
Well, my sense of what UFOs were about formed as a result, or was inspired by, one of these movies that we're talking about. It's called Invasion of the Saucer Men, and that movie, I think it was like kids who were out parking at places where they could make out, basically
necking.
they encountered aliens who had heads kind of like Brussels sprouts.
Right.
And who had little needles that would stick out of their fingers, and they could inject alcohol into people, which would make the people really drunk, you know. So that was one of the greats. That's a fine movie. I think you can find that one on YouTube, too.
Well, speaking of saucers, I have to make a confession. And I tried to fake a saucer photograph. And it almost cost me my life because I took two of my mom's favorite pie pans.
Oh, no.
Duct taped them together to make my saucer. And I was out behind the house tossing it in the air and trying to snap a picture of it. Of course, none of them came out. But my dad came home and goes, your mama's going to kill you, boy. It's like, oh. And she tried.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know I told you guys about when I saw those, when my whole family saw the UFOs in Connecticut. You know, that was my first sighting. And then we were taken up the hill to see it was almost a 20-foot diameter perfect circle with flattened, and it was burnt, that our aunt took us up to. And, you know, she said this stuff happened up there all the time. And you remember from the 60s, like Incident at Exeter and stuff like that, there was all that activity in the Northeast. And it seemed like every time we were up there, we went up there a lot to spend holidays with my father's mentor in New Hampshire. And I mean, I swear to God, we'd go outside and we'd see them moving around. At that same house, the mentor's daughter was out there in 66 on the porch with her girlfriends doing a slumber party kind of thing on the wraparound porch. And they were listening to the transistor radio, and all of a sudden, you know, they kind of dozed off, and then all of a sudden there was static, and they woke up and there was this massive ship, I guess you would call it, over the house. And it just slowly moved around, and they just like it freaked them out, obviously. And they went barreling upstairs screaming. And then my, the mentor and his wife, they came out and they saw it. They didn't know what it was. But she was traumatized by it, never spoke about it again. But her story was corroborated, is that the word? By, you know, because she was a cute teenage girl. There was a cute teenage guy hiding out in the graveyard across the square, spying on them, and he saw it too. You know, so it was stuff like that all the time. And then
what was the shape of it?
It was massive and round. It was round and I believe smooth on the bottom with like rotating lights kind of thing. And then they were very close to the White Mountains where the famous Betty and Barney Hill case took place. And because we had seen so much stuff and all that, when that movie UFO incident came out in the 70s, I think probably that was the 75, 74, 75, 76, something like that. There was the scene in the movie where, you know, they're driving along and they just, you know, this light comes over them, I think, and they, you know, they stop the car and they can't move basically. And there's a scene where these aliens are walking around, you know, they're like grays, right? But they have like uniforms on. I can't remember, but they come up to the car and like they're right at the car. I swear to God, I had nightmares forever. You know, it's just, yeah. Well, wow. Dang.
1961.
Wow.
And they didn't remember what had happened until they were hypnotized.
Right.
Well, I wasn't, abducted, but I may have been, and they washed my mind out. I mean, it probably needed a good scrubbing anyway. My experience with spotting what I feel was UFOs happened when I was living in the Oakland Hills, and there was a fire a couple of streets over. A woman's house had caught on fire, and it was really a big blaze. There were all sorts of cops and fire trucks there. And I ran over to see what was going on. And on my way walking back home after all the excitement had calmed down, I'm walking next to this Oakland cop. I mean, he was just right beside me. His car was parked actually right by my house. And we were walking up, and he suddenly just stopped and looked up, and he goes, "I'll be damned." And I go, "What?" He said, "Look at that." And he points up, and there's this formation. It's obviously something in an orbit, like when you see a satellite, only they were leaving a trail behind them. I don't know if it, you know, the explanation later on was, oh, it was a flight of meteoroids or, you know, whatever. But it was an actual, it was a very organized flight of meteoroids. And
were they in a V pattern at all, or?
Well, It was the kind of pattern you would see when you see military aircraft, you know.
Right.
A lead plane to
exactly.
And it was that kind of thing. I'm like, that doesn't look that looks organized. And the cop, I said, are you going to call that in? He said, oh, hell no. I want to keep my job.
Right.
That was what has happened up until now. Apparently, they claim the military is going to let everyone turn in all their UFO stories. But we'll see if that plays out, because that's overcoming decades and decades of, don't ask, don't tell, basically.
Right. Well, when you said, it just struck me when you said, like, that satellite size. That's exactly what I saw when I was in the Nevada desert. When I talked last week, I think when we're out in the middle of nowhere, 100 miles from any town in any direction, north of Pahrump, really close to Area 51. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know Area 51 then, right? But that was at my uncle's house, the guy who was ex-Project Blue Book. Mm-hmm. So go figure. I just went outside and it's the same thing, like a squadron of satellite sized lights, flying, barreling across the sky. And I was like,
I'm a confirmed fan of, the meteor storms. I've gone out and spent a whole lot of time waiting to see those meteorites, streak through the sky. This looked nothing like that.
There's
don't tell me it was a meteor, idiot. They don't fly in formation.
Right.
They don't fly at all. They fall.
Right.
Yeah, these were, this was directed flight. It wasn't coming down. It was going the kind of motion you see when you're watching the satellites. The ISS, the space station.
Right. Exactly. And and I've always been intrigued by, some of that footage that you see on YouTube or whatever of thing, like it's like the space station monitoring, and you see things flying across like really fast, that's not a satellite. That's obviously not an airplane. What the hell is that? And it's like, across the moon, across the Earth, it's like
So, what do you think these things are?
A number of astronauts claim they spotted those during the NASA missions, they were finally coming out with stories.
Right.
But what are these things?
Do not know. I've thought a lot about how, just the way they tend to like appear and disappear so easily, I'm like wondering if they're, cause we don't know, we don't grok. Think about how this new telescope that's out there has just, those pictures you've seen where it's expanded our comprehension of the universe by like a bazillion times more than it was even with Hubble. And every time we have one of those things, we have some kind of new understandings or expansion in consciousness. Just think about how the world changed when there was that time when we could only see certain colors. The colors were there, but we couldn't see them because the way our minds work,
Right.
And so I think maybe there's something to do with overlapping dimensions or something. I don't know. It's just, it always feels like they're moving through doorways in some weird way.
We are in the metaverse, to the prophet Zuckerberg.
I think the hypothesis that Jacques Vallée has is that there's some kind of interdimensional thing going on.
Right.
Though it's, nobody has a clue how that works either.
There are a lot of people who believe that it's not coming from space, but it's coming from the ocean, that there are actually very little of the ocean has been, explored, particularly the very deepest parts.
Right.
And you could hide it. You could hide New York City there and not find it.
Right. Yeah. And it's just, yeah, you know, things I've seen before where they, you know, a show about the Bermuda Triangle or whatever, and people are always seeing things coming in and out of the ocean. And I actually, another sighting I saw, and it was with my brother. This is right after my mother died, and we were in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. We were staying at a friend's cabin while we were, you know, just for comfort, comfortable place to stay as we went through her stuff. And where this cabin was between these two mountains, Kakapin and Sleepy Creek. And my brother's outside on the porch one night. He says, "Mags, you got to come here and see this." And I went out. We're sitting there watching this thing. It was a disc light kind of moving around, floating around. Then it would kind of go up here a little bit, and then it would float over here. We just watched it for about 20 minutes, and then it went into the mountain. Like, how did that, what, wait, what, you know, it's like, what? Yeah.
Yeah. I've read a lot of reports of that kind of activity of disappearing into the mountainous areas, and, you know, if they're that advanced, they should have the technical ability to create an underground base that's not easily detectable. So that's believable.
Yeah. Well, and then again, too, you know, where Berkeley Springs is really close to D.C. And, you know about the old, there's these weird facilities, out there. And like
the underground White House that they have out there.
Yeah. Or, like the Greenbrier Hotel. Yeah. That they've, look how, like with NORAD, for instance, Cheyenne Mountain is hollow, and it's, so who knows?
I certainly don't know.
What I want, though, is that I would like to get to the point. I was complaining about this the other night. I was telling Hunter, like, all the years I'd tell people these things I'd seen, and I'm not saying it's aliens or whatever. I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying, here's what I saw. And instead of people going, "Oh, that's interesting," like, I'm curious about that. There's this whole, what's up with that whole thing of the knee-jerk response so many people have of like, "Oh, that's stupid," or that can't be, you know, like, why don't you just, you know, that's why I like this Archives of the Impossible. That looks really cool. You know, I'm just curious about, like, why not, right? You know, it's things we can't explain. So why don't we explore it from a scientific mindset?
Well, it's kind of hard to think outside the box for some people, I think.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Some of us, I know you and I are that way, and Scoop, all of us can entertain notions that, you know, there are things outside our experience, outside of our perception. As we were talking earlier about, there's colors that we can't see, and we know that. There's sounds we can't hear, and we know that.
Right.
But most people are sort of in the reality they're in, and they don't really, I mean, they're not really comfortable, I think. I think it's outside of their comfort zone to think about
there's
things that
place
are
it.
So mysterious.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
I just get tired of seeing, you know, you watch any news show, right? And there's some news sighting or whatever, and they always do the ho ho ho, you know, and they play the ooh wee ooh music, and like, ho ho, it's aliens.
Those crazy people spotting those things.
Well, I mean, if you really, really think about it, it can be scary, you know? And if you think about the universe and how big it is and how small we are, that can be scary too.
Right.
And you most know people what don't want to think about that stuff.
What would be scary is if someone was dropped into Austin or any big city these days from, you know, 50 years ago, and they had to look at all this stuff, seeing pizza delivery by robot going down the street, you know, driverless cars, people talking on smartphones, you know, that's all the stuff we read about in science fiction when we were kids.
Hey.
Like, we have it now. Well, now what?
Dick Tracy's right. two-way wrist radio.
I always wanted one, and I never could.
You got one now.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, like I saw it. Didn't I see somewhere that Rich McKinnon just got, he got like the Star Trek insignia communicator so he can answer calls? Well,
I want one. I'm not big on the Apple Watch because, you know, I have enough right. Apple stuff, but if I could have me a badge there that talked back.
You're talking on your phone. It could make that little tee-tee, that little chirping sound and everything. I'd be all over that like a cheap suit.
Shoot, we're bringing up Star Trek and we only have 2 minutes left. And I would have launched off into that about how great the new Star Trek series is.
I just watched last night and I love that.
It's really great.
And I've been watching the Picard.
Picard was just fantastic. Yeah. Second season.
I just caught up on that. And I like what they're doing with that. I was questioning they're going to just turn it into a shit show on TV and it's just going to be ridiculous. But the stuff that they've been coming up with, I think it has to do with Eugene Roddenberry being involved with it. It helps when the family has a say in what's going on. And that's kind of the key to these franchises. When they lose touch with the originators, that's when they usually turn to crap.
Right.
Well,
right.
And they've got some amazing people involved. Michael Chabon is like one of the showrunners on Star Trek Discovery. And he's like one of our finest novelists, you know. And who is it? Akiva Goldman is involved in all of those things. And I can't remember who all, but there are a number of people involved who are really excellent creative forces, you know. And they understand the value of Star Trek, and they're trying to bring it back.
Done out there. I'm waiting for The Mandalorian next.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know what's happened.
This is the way.
We have run out of time.
Oh, wow. No. We've been canceled. Where's that cancel culture coming?
We're out of time. We're out of space.
Thank you, folks. That was great fun.
Yeah
I really enjoyed that.
Yeehaw. All right. We'll see you next week.
Live long and prosper.
Right on.
All right. I can, there we go. I can do it. Yeah, there we go. Bye.
Bye. How do you do that? Hook 'em horns. Oh, well.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.